Chapter 14. We stayed on the landing deck until the evening air turned cold, with chatterlings, guests, and Emirian functionaries mingling amidst floating trays laden with drinks and nibbles. Most of the other chatterlings had been on Emir for years, but Campion and I were only days of subjective time away from the reunion system. To us, the mental wound was still bright and agonizing, much too raw to be soothed by banter and idle reassurance. In a restless moment, I pulled away from the crowd and made my way to the edge of the deck, standing with my feet close to the unguarded edge. It was a long way down to the sloping ground of the Benevolence Finger, and even further to the twinkling, ever-shifting dunes beneath.
"If you listen carefully, you can hear it singing,"
Campion said softly, for he had joined me at the edge.
"I can't hear anything, not with that party going on."
"They're filtering inside. In a little while there'll just be a few stragglers like you and me left outdoors."
"Did you smooth things over with Bettany?"
Campion grinned quickly.
"I think so.
He says he'll have to make sure the elephant only gets to access trove data that has been doctored to fit the story, but they've been doing that since he got here anyway. They'll have to make a few more changes to gloss over the bit about the Stardam failure, but it shouldn't be a problem."
"They should just tell him. It isn't kind, keeping him in the dark like that."
"But see it from their side."
"He wouldn't blow up."
"I don't know. It's not as if something like that hasn't happened before."
"There's precedence for everything in galactic history. Every conceivable event has already happened at least once, but that doesn't make it likely that it'll happen again here and now."
"Fine. You go and tell him. I'll take a trip back up to orbit and watch the fireworks.
And abandon me down here."
Campion closed his hand around mine. "Not really."
After a while I said, "What did you think about the robots?"
"I'm glad they're here. Now that Cadence and Cascade are involved, it means it's more than just Gentian line that's been attacked. If the machine people feel aggrieved, we'll have their power backing us all the way. I'd certainly rather have them on my side than against me."
"I was thinking more about their attitude to Hesperus."
"In what way?"
"Do you actually think they want to help him?"
"That's what they said, isn't it?"
I pulled my gown tighter against the chill.
"I don't know.
How can we be sure they're not just going to dismantle him, rather than making him well again?"
"If making him well isn't an option, dismantling may be the only alternative. At least that way they'll be able to access the information he accumulated before his amnesia."
"But he's our friend, Campion. We can't just hand him over like some worn-out thing, to be stripped down and recycled."
"He's a machine. That's what happens when they break down."
"Possibly the coldest thing you've ever said."
"It's not that I don't care," Campion said hastily, "but we have to be realistic. Who stands a better chance of fixing him? The machine people, the civilization he came from, or some nebulous entity called the Spirit of the Air, about which we know almost nothing?"
He shook his head. "Anyway, aren't we being a little premature? They haven't even seen him yet. Shouldn't we wait to hear what they have to say after that?"
"Cadence and Cascade are just two robots. They might know how to fix him, but that doesn't mean they have the resources this far from the Monoceros ring."
"Then we let them take him home."
"Campion, he sent us a message. He was very specific about Naomi. He couldn't have known Cadence and Cascade were going to be here, but he did know about the spirit."
"If he'd known about the other robots, he'd have told us to entrust him to them. Before he risked his life for us, he told us to make sure we got his notes and drawings back to his people."
"That's not the same as saying he'd have entrusted himself to them."
"We can talk about this all night and still not get any nearer to agreement. Besides, it's pointless speculating about the Spirit of the Air before we've talked to the Magistrate again. From where I was standing, she didn't sound awfully keen on the idea of giving us direct access to it."
"We're a line," I said. "We ask nicely the first time, but if we don't get what we want, we take it anyway. That's the way we've always done things. It's the way we're expected to do things."
"Go around bullying lesser cultures, you mean?"
"We've been around long enough to earn the right."
I groaned inwardly, listening to myself. It was the kind of thing I loathed to hear coming out of the mouths of other chatterlings. The idea that we would use force the instant diplomacy and persuasion failed us.
bully our way around, in other words, just as Campion put it. But I was only thinking of Hesperus. I did not want anything or anyone to stand in the way of bringing him back to life.
Listen, Campion said. It's starting.
What?
The music. The song of the dunes.
I heard it then, although the sound must have been rising in intensity for several minutes, pushing itself into audibility. Campion was correct that most of the celebrants had moved into the tower, leaving only a dozen or so people on the deck, most of whom were silent. The noise was low and alien, a mournful, bass-rich drone that rose and fell in pitch like a deathly slow siren.
"Is it the wind?"
I whispered, hardly daring to speak.
"Not the wind, no. It works best when the air is almost totally still."
"You haven't been here before."
"But I've been on worlds with dunes before. So have you, but probably never at the right time. Face it, there are a lot of experiences neither of us have had yet. It's why we keep living."
"So, if not the wind?"
"It's all down to avalanches," Campion said, in the same respectful whisper. "Sand grains start sliding downhill just beneath the outer membrane of the dunes. Actually, the technical term is barkens. Those are the sinuous dunes where you get the right conditions for the singing. The avalanching grains set up some kind of resonance with the outermost layer. It starts oscillating, rippling free like a vast drumskin. The oscillations feed back into the avalanching grains, forcing them to synchronize themselves. The membrane vibrates even more strongly and sets up excitations in the surrounding air mass. You get something like music."
After a pause, he said,
"Wonderful, isn't it?"
"Wonderful, and a little spooky."
"Like all the best things in the universe."
After a pause, he said,
"I was talking to Seifel just now."
"You always did have an eye for her."
"I looked, but I didn't touch. The point is, she said something that made me think. We've a lot on our minds at the moment. Hesperus, the other robots, Grilsa, and the other prisoners. Why anyone would want to destroy the line, and what will happen if they find us again. Enough worry for a lifetime, even by line standards. But despite all of that, we're still alive. We're still alive, and we still have friends. And somewhere to stay. And it's a beautiful evening, and the dunes of Niume are singing to us. Those dunes aren't just any old dunes, you know. They're the shattered remains of the Provider megastructures, after their culture fell out of the sky. We're being serenaded by the twinkling remains of a dead super-civilization, the relics of people who thought themselves gods, if only for a few instants of galactic time. Now, how does that make you feel?"
"Like I've overstayed my welcome," I said.
The line was in private session for breakfast, on a terrace near the top of the building's onion-shaped summit. The terrace was partially open, with one half covered by a domed roof. Ymir crowded away in all directions, with vehicles and citizens flitting between towers in ceaseless, dizzying motion. There were coloured flags on the bridges and aerial promenades. The air was cool but invigorating, and I felt refreshed after the night's sleep. The world's rotation had been adjusted to a line standard day circuits ago, and because we were near the vernal equinox, Ymir had enjoyed nearly 12 hours of uninterrupted darkness. Campion and I arrived at the breakfast table together. It was set out in a square shape, with 12 to 15 spaces to a side. In the middle of the square was a display volume filled with a rotating view of the galaxy. Food and drink were laid out in abundance. Campion and I had been told when breakfast would be served, but the others had obviously been there for some time. By the time we arrived, the only two vacant seats available were on opposite sides of the square. We stood for a puzzled moment, hand in hand.
"I'll move," Batia said, who happened to be sitting next to one of the empty positions. She made to stand, gathering the hem of her dress in preparation.
"There's no need," said Medic, with amused laughter in his voice. "I am sure Campion and Purslane will not mind sitting apart, any more than the rest of us would. Or am I missing something?"
"It's all right," I said to Batia. "You don't have to get up, but thank you for offering."
I took my seat next to her, while Campion settled into the one between Henbane and Teasel. Bettany, who was sitting at the equilateral position between us,
lifted a glass of orange juice to his lips. "Did you sleep well, Shatterlings?" he asked between sips. "Was the accommodation to your tastes?"
"We've no complaints," Campion said. Each of us had at least an entire floor of the tower to ourselves, subdivided into several high-ceilinged rooms with panoramic windows and curving cave-like walls.
"You presume to speak for Purslane as well?" Bettany asked, with exaggerated pleasantness.
"Campion knows my tastes," I said. "He was right to speak for me. Anyway, we slept together. You all know it, or at least suspect it, so why the pretense?"
"When the line is in its darkest hour, you could at least attempt to abide by the traditions," Bettany said.
"So you've never screwed another Shatterling," I said.
"Over breakfast, Purslane? Please."
"You raised the matter, Bettany, not me."
Aconite lifted a calming hand. "Let's cut them some slack, shall we? We might not approve of every detail of their relationship, but the line still owes them a considerable debt."
Bettany looked disappointed, but said nothing.
"If you're going to censure us, now would be the time," Campion said. Nonchalantly, he reached for a crust of bread and tore off a corner. He was so cool about it that I felt a shiver of almost indecent pride. "However, I think you're all far too sensible for that. Yes, we broke the rules, but the rules don't mean a damn now. Gentian line as we know it is over. We might build something from the ruins, but let's not pretend it's going to have much to do with the institution Abigail created 6 million years ago."
"The line still has legitimacy," Gallengale said, without any particular rancor. "But I take your point. Campion and Purslane aren't the only Shatterlings to have fluttered with the notion of consorting during circuits. They may have taken rule-bending further than most of us, but there have always been others."
"Nobody sitting around this table," Bettany said.
Gallengale scratched at the metal border of his artificial eye. It was like an iron badge glued to his face, with a small red gem in the middle. "Perhaps not, but the time may still have come to let bygones be bygones. What's so harmful about a little screwing around between friends?"
"It's not what Abigail wanted," Bettany said. "A harmless fuck here and there during the Thousand Nights, that's different. The occasional orgy, yes. But we don't consort. We don't fall in love, have children, live happily ever after. That's not what Abigail made us for."
"Abigail believed in flexibility as well," Gallengale said. "If she were sitting at this table, she might very well have come around to Purslane and Campion's line of thinking."
"That's your opinion," Bettany said.
"If we hadn't consorted," I said, "neither of us would have been late for the reunion. We'd most likely have been caught in the ambush and died along with all the others."
"She has a point," Gallengale said. "Perhaps the sensible thing would be to put this little infringement behind us and move on. Without Purslane and Campion's involvement, we wouldn't have the 5 other Shatterlings or the prisoners." He brushed crumbs from his lips.
"Speaking of which, have we decided how we're going to proceed? It should be straightforward to bring the 3 Gentians out of stasis, but we'll need to be more cautious where the prisoners are concerned. Then there's the question of what we do to them once they're out." He looked sharply at Mazerion, who was sitting on the opposite side of the table from Aconite, as if the 2 of them had barely spoken.
"With the sanction of the line, I would like to lead the interrogation," Mazerion said, "under due scrutiny, of course. But they're our prisoners. We caught them and kept them intact until Campion came by. Rightly or wrongly, I feel a sense of unfinished business."
"I don't think any of us will have a problem with you leading the inquiry," Bettany said. "Under line supervision, as you say. Do you have a plan?"
"I'll save Grilser for last. I think he's the one we'll get the most out of, and the one most likely to survive re-emergence into normal time. If I can get him out in one piece, I'd like to press for extraordinary interrogation measures."
"Sectioning," said Charlock disgustedly.
"It's another tool in the arsenal," Mazerion said with an easy shrug.
"Which we haven't used for circuits," Charlock said, "which is considered a barbaric throwback to the Dark Ages by a good many enlightened nascents.
But not by the commonality, which is all that counts. We won't be breaking any applicable laws."
Something wild flared in Mazerion's eyes. We were the ones who were ambushed and pushed to the brink of terminal attrition, not some other lines or nascents. Let them get a taste of extinction and see how long their principles last. Do you imagine that Marcelins would even blink before using the same technique on one of us, if it came to that?
Torturing Grilsa won't necessarily get the answers you're looking for, Charlock said.
It isn't torture. Torture involves pain. We won't hurt him at all.
Aside from the ethical issues, do we even have the means? Bettany asked, steepling his fingers under his chin.
The apparatus can be constructed very easily, Mazerian said. Any one of our troves should carry the Maker templates. Judging by what I've seen of Ymir, we could do it even if we had to rely on local resources.
She sprinkled sugar onto a piece of fruit on her plate. She had already sliced the fruit into translucent slivers, as if rehearsing the act of sectioning.
"Let us agree that Mazerian will lead the interrogation," Bettany said, looking around the table for signs of dissent. "Aconite, I presume you'll wish to be involved. We'll get the other three shatterlings out of abeyance as soon as possible, and give them the option of joining the interrogation party. The rest of us, meanwhile, will perform the necessary oversight and scrutiny. But we won't place undue limits on Mazerian's authority. Most of us either avoided the ambush entirely or escaped it at the time of the attack. Mazerian and the other survivors were there for years, surviving by the skin of their teeth. They're owed a crack of the whip."
Anxious to turn the conversation away from torture and interrogation, I said, "Given what you've learned since arriving on Naume, have any of you come to any conclusions as to why we were ambushed?"
"What can it be other than a simple grudge?" asked Bettany.
"We are not the strongest line in the commonality, and we have much less leverage over dominant nascents than some of the other lines, so it can't be that we were attacked out of jealousy or because of some underlying political motive. For 6 million years we have been content to mind our own business, doing good works where appropriate, providing the occasional star dam here and there, but otherwise standing aloof from the nitty-gritty of turnover. We've seldom dirtied our hands with galactic affairs, preferring to witness and record rather than intercede. Any enemies we may have made have most likely been extinct for circuits."
"I'm hearing a lot of reasons why someone wouldn't hold a grudge against us," Campion said.
Bettany looked sympathetic. "Then you misunderstand human nature, my dear fellow. People will hate us simply for being what we are, a force for good, for benign non-interference. The mere fact that we haven't dirtied our hands, that we've maintained an unblemished reputation, that's enough to make someone detest us."
"Another line?" I asked.
Bettany nodded. "That may well be so, Purslane. Certainly a line might have the wherewithal to assemble the weapons that were used against us, the Marcelins in particular."
"The Marcelins have been our allies since the Golden Hour," I said. "We gave them cloning expertise, they gave us ships. In all that time, there's never been a hint that they held anything against us."
"It's often the close friend who's the first to stick the dagger in," Bettany said.
"What if we were attacked for another reason entirely?" Campion asked.
"Nurturing a theory?" Bettany asked. Campion glanced at Aconite.
"Maybe you should tell him, if you still think it's relevant."
Aconite coughed and took a mouthful of water.
"The only concrete thing we got out of Grilsa before we had to dial him back up was that he claimed the ambush was somehow due to Campion."
Bettany squinted.
"Campion?"
"That's what the man said."
"He could have been lying."
Campion leaned forward. "We thought it over. The only thing that makes sense, given that I wasn't at the reunion when it happened, is that there must have been something in my strand, the one I contributed a circuit ago."
Mazerian said, "No one thinks Campion was responsible. If they do, they can explain it to me after breakfast, but it's quite possible he may have triggered it inadvertently. If there was something in his thread, something that led to the ambush at the next reunion, we must find out what it was."
Bettany glared at Campion.
"And you have no idea what this trigger might have been?"
Campion explained his theory that his visit to the Vigilance might have drawn down the ambush, pointing out that Hesperus and the late Dr. Menninx had both been curious about the Galactic Archivists.
"All of a sudden there's a lot of interest in the Vigilance," Campion concluded.
The machine people decide to send an envoy there. But he doesn't make it before having his memory wiped. Something snags Dr. Menninx's curiosity, and perhaps something I revealed about the vigilance was sufficient to trigger the ambush.
"You found something of shattering importance, but you don't remember what it was?" Bettany asked.
"Someone may have seen something in my strand that I missed," Campion said, unfazed by the other Shatterling's amused skepticism. "We'll need to look at my strand in detail, all of us. Something I revealed was damaging or threatening to someone, enough that they thought it worthwhile to try to annihilate all of us."
Gallingale said, "Someone who was at the reunion, you mean? One of us?"
"The H-guns arrived inside ships of the line," I said. "There's no other way they'd have got within shooting range of the reunion world before interception. Aconite and Mazerion will back me up on that one." I looked at Aconite and he held up his hand in a gesture of willing surrender. Mazerion nodded once.
"Someone knew where the reunion was going to take place," Campion answered. "That already implies access to privileged information, and Fescue was convinced that the familial network had been broken into. Reading between the lines, I'm sure he already suspected one of us was responsible. If he were sitting here now, I'm certain he'd be asking the hard questions."
Sifel spoke for the first time, brushing a strand of blue-white hair from her dark, dreamy eyes. I was seeing her through my eyes, but with Campion's memories getting in the way. "Most of us arrived at the reunion in time to be ambushed, but the threading hadn't begun. We were still waiting for the last stragglers before beginning the Thousand Nights, which means that the Strands died with the Shatterlings. We'll never know what they did during their final circuits."
We all looked at her, not quite sure what point she was making.
"But we do know their intentions," Sifel said. She had a voice like dark chocolate. "Before we departed for space, after the last reunion, we all filed our flight plans. None of us were obliged to keep to them slavishly. We're meant to change our plans as interesting data comes in. But we still know what most of us were planning to do."
"I don't see," Bettany started.
"If the flight plans are still on record," Sifel said, "we can review them and see if any of us were intending to act on Campion's strand."
"I'd have remembered if anyone else was going to the vigilance," Campion said.
"It won't be that clear-cut," Sifel replied. "But the Vigilance collates and studies information from across the galaxy, from many systems. You may have reported something that spurred someone else to make a follow-up investigation, without ever going anywhere near the Vigilance itself."
Aconite said, "It's worth looking into."
"Very well," Bettany said, his tone grudging. "Sifel, can we entrust this one to you?"
"I don't mind. As long as I have the usual access privileges, I'm as capable of doing it as anyone else. I'll need a clean copy of Campion's strand, obviously."
She turned her radiant features towards him. "Would that be a problem?"
"It might," Campion said quietly.
"I don't follow," Bettany said. "We all had free access to your strand a circuit ago. Why should it be a difficulty now?"
"Because it doesn't exist. I deleted it."
Aconite gaped. "But on the ship you told us."
"I was wrong, all right. I thought there might possibly be a working backup somewhere in the trove. There wasn't. I screwed up."
"Why would anyone delete their own strand?" Tansy asked, stupefied.
"It was a mistake."
"An honest error. Happens to us all," Charlock said.
"It wasn't that kind of mistake," Campion said. "More of a misjudgment. I got rid of it because I was fed up hauling all that past around with me. I felt like a man dragging an endless chain of sacks behind him, each of them stuffed with enough experience for an entire lifetime."
Seeing the expressions on the faces of many of the Shatterlings, Campion reddened.
"They were my memories. I did what I wanted with them. That's my human right, above and beyond anything the line tells me to do."
"Oh, Campion," I said under my breath, because as much as I wanted to be on his side, I knew what he had done was almost unforgivable.
"I didn't think it really mattered," he went on. "I knew the threading apparatus would retain a clean copy, which would still be in its memory when we convened for the next reunion."
"The threading apparatus was destroyed by the H-guns," Bettany said.
"I wasn't to know that."
"But you put us in a position where that was the only clean copy in existence."
"Hindsight's a lovely thing," Campion said.
You were already skating very close to censure. This takes you well over the line.
We were all smiles yesterday, Bettany. What's changed?
You were owed a cordial welcome, like any survivors. But that doesn't change the fact that you flouted line traditions, took undue risks, treated your strand with cavalier disregard. Those weren't your memories to erase, Campion. You were merely entrusted with them on behalf of Gentian Line.
Well, whatever it is you want to do with me, you have my full permission. But can I just suggest that the punishment, whatever it is, wait until we've worked out who wants to kill us?
Before we hang Campion out to dry, Sifel said, we should keep this in mind. We all received his strand. That means we still have 50-odd copies of it between us, all of which will have been mnemonically tagged.
But degraded by the passage of time and buried under new memories, Mazarian said, sounding as if she was making a reasonable point rather than trying to twist the knife.
Sifel nodded. I know, but it isn't irrecoverable. I'm not saying we can reassemble a clean copy, but I'm sure we can get very close if we pool our minds. If everyone is willing to submit to memory retrieval again, I can extract the individual versions of Campion's strand and cross-correlate them until the holes are filled and the errors corrected.
It's worth a try, Aconite said.
That puts a lot of responsibility on your shoulders, Sifel, said Bettany.
I'll cope.
Bettany tapped a chunk of bread against his head, like a judge about to deliver a verdict.
So shall it be. Mazarian will lead the Inquisition into the prisoners. Sifel will handle the retrieval of the Campion's strand in so far as it can be recovered. Tansy, I believe you are on patrol duty today, and that, I think, is more than enough business for one breakfast.
Might I say something? I asked.
Bettany smiled at me.
Naturally, Perslane.
Are we to be censured or not? I'd like to get it out in the open here and now.
You've only just arrived. The nature of your censure is a complex one with many factors. It can't be decided instantly.
As far as I'm concerned, there's only one factor. We consorted. The fact that we were late has nothing to do with it. It could have happened to anyone else. We brought the line, 5 survivors it wouldn't otherwise have got back, and the prisoners, and Hesperus.
To which we must also add Campion's unfortunate treatment of his strand.
Censure me for that, by all means, but leave Perslane out of it, Campion said.
Unfortunately, by consorting, by arriving together, by flouting your feelings for each other, you have demonstrated your willingness to be censured as a couple. So shall it be.
Shatterlings have wiped their strands before, I said. No one got censured for it then, so why pick on Campion and me now?
Bettany looked strained. Calm down, please. If there is to be censured, it will be mild, and your former good conduct will be taken into account. There will be no talk of excommunication from the line. Nothing you have done even begins to warrant that. But there must be discipline, Perslane, now more than ever.
I sank back in my seat, feeling as if I had been slapped hard in the face. My hands were shaking, so I buried them in my lap. The worst thing was that I almost agreed with him.
There did have to be discipline, especially considering our perilous position. Shatterlings had free will most of the time. But what if one of us were to whisk aboard our ship and head back to the reunion system, thereby alerting the ambushers to our hideaway? I would have no qualms about pursuing and executing a shatterling who did that, even if they were Gentian. I would even fire the gamma cannon myself if I believed that the line's existence depended on it.
Can I make one request? I asked, when the color had returned to my cheeks.
Go ahead, Bettany said. Before we arrived around Naume, Hesperus communicated a wish to Campion and me. It was clear that he wanted to be brought to Naume and into the presence of the spirit of the air.
He made this explicit.
As explicit as he could, given the circumstances. My throat grew dry. I sensed that if I did not make my case convincingly now, I would not get a second chance. I spoke to the magistrate already, but it wasn't the right time to persuade her. Now I'd like lying backing to press for contact with the spirit.
Did you mention this to Cadence and Cascade?
I didn't want to mention the spirit again with the magistrate around.
They will have their own view as how to proceed, Bettany said. If Hesperus is one of them, the simplest thing would be to hand him over and consider the matter closed.
The simplest, but not necessarily the right thing, Aconite said. If Hesperus communicated a specific desire to Purslane, we have to honor it.
I agree, Henbane said.
But we can't afford to anger the machine people either, said Wynne, a male shatterling who had been silent until now. If they want to examine Hesperus, what right do we have to insist otherwise?
It does put us in a diplomatic bind, Saint Foyne said thoughtfully. But as Elaine, our responsibility has always been to our guests, above any other concerns. If Hesperus did make this request of Purslane, we must honor his wishes. That doesn't necessarily imply a confrontation with the machine people. Cadence and Cascade have been more than understanding until now, and I don't expect that to change if we explain our predicament to them.
You know them better than any of us, Bettany said to Saint Foyne, the shatterling who had brought the robots to the reunion in the first place.
They're reasonable, she said. They'll see our side of things, but that doesn't mean we should ignore any suggestions they make.
Aconite said, you have my unconditional backing, Purslane, for what it's worth.
Mine too,
Mazarian said, and you can include Valerian, Lucerne, and Melilot. They'll back you all the way when they learn what Hesperus did for us.
Thank you, I said.
Count me in, Henbane said. Before the murmur of approval turned into a storm, Bettany nodded once.
Very well. Purslane has line authority to petition the Niume administration for access to the Spirit of the Air. But before you take the matter any further, Purslane, have you the faintest idea what you're dealing with?
Campion came to my room later that morning, while I was waiting to hear back from the magistrate concerning my request for an audience. I was standing on the little low-walled balcony that jutted out from the side of the room, accessed through a matter-permeable window, composing my thoughts, trying to marshal the facts of my case into something resembling a persuasive, logically sustained argument. Bettany's had unsettled me, opening a chink of doubt where before there had been only neutron-dense certainty. I had gone into the trove and learned that the spirit's displeasure had brought down entire civilizations. But we also had the spirit to thank for the fact that anyone could live on Naomi in the first place. In the absence of any large-scale organisms, it was the spirit that kept the atmosphere in its current, dynamically unstable state, absorbing carbon dioxide from the air and returning oxygen. There was no way the machine intelligence was doing that simply for its own benefit. So it tolerated us, even perhaps encouraged our presence. But that did not mean it would spare me if it judged me an irritation. I looked out towards the slivers of clear blue sky visible between the golden towers of Ymir, and wondered if I had the nerve to do what had to be done.
I brought you this.
I turned around at Campion's voice, watching as he stepped through onto the balcony. He was clutching a piece of chocolate bread wrapped in paper.
Thank you.
I didn't have any more of an appetite than you did, but I reckoned you'd get some of yours back by mid-morning. I took the chocolate bread and bit into a corner.
You're right, as usual. I've got a stomach full of butterflies, but I'm still hungry. How do you think we did back there?
Atrociously, but I don't think anyone could have done much better, given what we had to work with.
I'm surprised at Bettany.
I'm not. He's a schemer who's just seen his chance to exert real influence within the line. It was never a possibility when Fescu and the other alpha males were around, but now he's almost got a clear field to himself.
Don't forget the alpha females.
And did you see how he lorded it over that table, as if we'd already voted him emperor? And he has the gall to accuse me of flouting line traditions. We're supposed to be egalitarian, without leaders.
In times of crisis, the line is allowed to form a decision-making quorum.
Yes, but we've managed to get by without one for most of our history. You can be sure that Bettany was at the head of the queue when the idea of forming a new quorum was mooted. I wouldn't be surprised if he suggested it. Why do we need a quorum anyway? We're perfectly capable of taking decisions en masse, more so now than ever.
The others will keep him in check. We've still got friends. Did you see how they rallied when I asked for permission to visit the magistrate? Half the table was behind me. What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing, really. I'm just wondering whether that vote of support was as sympathetic as it appeared. How could it be anything other than sympathetic?
Some of them could be hoping that you fall flat on your face by being denied access. I wouldn't even be surprised if one or two are hoping you do get access, and then make a fool of yourself with the spirit.
No one wants me to die, though.
No, Campion said. They're not that bad. Some of them may not like us, but we're still kin. I wouldn't wish death on another Gentian shatterling, and I don't think the others are any different.
I'd like to think so. I'm still worried about this censure thing, though. I feel as if there's a sword hanging over me.
If it works out with Hesperus, all our problems could be over.
All of them?
All right, Campion said. Some of them. But at least he'd speak up for us. Who's going to doubt the word of a machine person?
In other words, there's even more reason to risk everything with the spirit.
That and the fact that he's our friend, and it'd be great to have him back.
I've been doing some reading. Bettany wasn't exaggerating. We could be putting ourselves at risk with the spirit.
We've been putting ourselves at risk since they hatched us.
True. I finished the chocolate bread and started folding the paper into an origami dove. Thanks for thinking of me. No matter what happens here, no matter what happens to us after Naume, I'm glad we're together.
I'm not going anywhere without you.
At least our consorting is out in the open now. No need to be coy about it.
Campion looked grave. They'll make us pay one way or another. I hope you realize that.
I finished the dove. It gained a pair of almond-colored eyes and water-colored feathers and started flapping. I released it into the air and watched it fly away into the distance, heading off to be recycled. Campion and I held hands, then pulled ourselves close to each other. Let them do their worst. I'm ready for it. Presently there was a chime from my room. Ginderbine's office was on the very summit of her building, in a four-sided cupola, affording excellent views in all directions. Wings, hung like ceremonial sabers, decorated the walls between the windows. Their glassy facets were stained in ruby, green, and blue, and inscribed with wavery lines of Emirian script. There were also photographs and a couple of strange, rebus-like Naume art pieces, all of which resembled the blueprints for fiendishly difficult garden mazes. Three of the bulbous convex windows revealed only a dense cityscape of golden spires, but the fourth, westerly-facing window looked out to the silver desert, where the endlessly shifting Barkans reached in serpentine waves all the way to the horizon. It was a clear, still day, and I could see a solitary white tower at the limit of visibility.
"This is an extraordinarily unusual request," Ginderbine informed us when we had taken seats facing her desk. "You must understand my natural skepticism. Gentian line has never shown much interest in this world, yet all of a sudden you want access to our deepest mysteries."
There was a complicated hooker-like apparatus perched on Ginderbine's desk, a painted kettle, hissing and burbling, festooned with pipes and valves. Now and then the fine furred magistrate would inhale from a mouthpiece on the end of a segmented hose. Campion and I had been given two cups of watery ginger-flavored tea. The crockery kept chinking in our hands.
"You flatter us with your attention," Ginderbine went on, "but I can't help feeling like a woman receiving insincere compliments because she has something someone wants. What do your troves tell you about the spirit?"
"That it is also known as the fractocoagulation," I said. "That it is an airborne entity composed of many individual elements. That it was once a human mind, a human being, a man who may once have been called Valmik, who was alive in the golden hour."
"Then it would seem that you are wasting your time."
Campion spoke now. "The trove also tells us that the spirit of the air has occasionally interceded to raise the dead, both biological and machine."
"It has also killed many individuals who were not dead to begin with."
"But the trove also says that many of the incidents could be blamed on provocation by the involved parties," Campion replied, "by them acting in a way that was known to irritate the spirit."
"No one went to the spirit intending to provoke it, Shatterling. They all thought they were being cleverer than those who'd come before."
"We don't," I said. "We're fully aware of the risks, and that we might not survive a direct encounter. But we still have to do this. We owe it to our friend.
Jindabyne sucked on her pipe. The kettle bubbled furiously.
The machine person. Shouldn't he be entrusted to Cadence and Cascade?
They'll be consulted, obviously, I said. But Hesperus must have known that the spirit offered his best chance of survival, not his fellow machines.
Jindabyne scratched the honey-coloured fur on the side of her cheek. Until the light caught her at a certain angle, the fur could have been mistaken for human skin.
You put me in an invidious position.
All we're asking for is the same access privileges that have already been granted to countless travellers in the past, I said.
Times were different then. The spirit was more predictable. Lately, I'm talking of recent centuries, not years, it has grown more capricious. There were some unpleasant incidents. The Scientific Council convinced the combined authorities that there should be no more casual encounters. So far, the spirit has confined its displeasure to individuals or small groups of individuals. But what if it should tire of human presence on Naomi? They say it brought down the plastic, and later, the providers.
If it didn't want your company, I imagine it would have got rid of you already, Campion said.
Easy for you to say. You're just guests here. You can leave any time you want. You don't depend on the spirit for the air you breathe.
We understand, I said soothingly. We're making an unusual request, and you're perfectly entitled to turn us down. But I promise you that we won't do anything without the guidance of the Scientific Council. If there is any hint that the spirit is being displeased, we'll stop immediately.
You know I cannot refuse you, Jindabyne said.
Of course you can, I said.
Really? With the full weight of Gentian line watching my every move?
There may be fewer than 50 ships in orbit around Naomi, but we all know what those ships could do to Naomi if we refuse to cooperate. You could turn these towers to dust, scour everything back to the last relics of the Benevolence.
It isn't like that at all, Campion said. We didn't come here to bully our way into anything.
You may not think so. Privately it may even be true. But you are a line, a member of the commonality. The lines always get what they want. There are never exceptions.
But we asked, I said plaintively.
In the full and certain knowledge of my eventual compliance.
Not Gentian line, Campion said. That's never been how we do things.
Then if I refused, that would be an end to it.
Campion and I exchanged wary looks.
Yes, I said, absolutely. You have sovereignty here. We don't.
Chatelain Bettany is a determined man. If you took news of my refusal to him, how do you think he'd respond?
Not well, I suspect.
You may have principles, Chatelains, but acting collectively you are monsters. I have seen it from other lines.
We are not monsters, I said. If you don't believe me, turn us down. I swear no harm will come to you.
And 1,000 years from now, 10,000, nothing to you.
Everything's different now, Campion said. Even if we did act like that in the past, we're not the same now.
Jindabyne placed her mouthpiece in the clawed hook of a malachite desk stand.
Go now, she said, picking up a sheet of paper from her desk.
You will have word of my decision later today. Cadence and Cascade met me on a private balcony of the tower where we had our rooms. It was noon. Campion reclined in a low chair with an apple in his hand, saying as little as he could get away with.
Thank you for agreeing to come, I said, nodding at the two flawless creatures.
Cadence, the silver one with the female anatomy, nodded.
It is the least we could do, Perslain. Cascade and I are most anxious to visit Hesperus and see what may be done for him. It may surprise you that we have feelings of compassion towards our fellow machines, but that is how we are. It tears at us to think that Hesperus may be suffering.
Do you die? I asked.
Of course we die, Cascade said. We are not indestructible. Far from home, far from the support systems of our culture, we are scarcely less vulnerable to injury than human beings.
He touched a white finger to his chest. With the right weapon, you could kill me now.
But your experiences have been recorded somewhere else. back in the Monoceros ring.
The nearest part of the ring is tens of thousands of lights away. Much has happened to me since my departure, very little of which has been communicated back home. If I were to die now, it would take tens of thousands of years for news of my death to reach the ring. Then they might activate a copy of me, with my last full set of memories. But I would not consider that entity to be me, merely an entity with whom I have certain things in common. He bowed his beautiful head. You must understand, being a Shatterling. Each of you carries a very similar set of memories, but that does not mean you would think lightly of dying.
No, I said, we wouldn't. But what about Hesperus? Could he really die?
Undoubtedly. Until we examine him, we can only speculate about the nature of his injuries. What is certain is that his chances of being repaired will be greatest if he is returned to the ring.
We would need a ship for that, Cadence said.
You don't have one.
Saint Foyne brought us here. We have no vehicle of our own.
Campion crunched noisily on his apple, the ancient human sound punctuating my thoughts. He was observing things very carefully, though giving every impression of studied indifference.
You must have had a ship at some point, I said. Once, Cadence said offhandedly, it was destroyed long before we reached the Dorcas reunion. Since then we have been at the mercy of human charity.
The robot waved a hand as if to wipe away the problem.
It is of no matter. Ships are mute machines with no more sentience than a pebble. They have no intrinsic value to us.
It would be good if you could look at Hesperus, I said. At the very least, help me to get him down to Naomi in one piece. I'm afraid of moving him now.
There is no need for him to come here, Cascade said. Whatever we can do for him, we can do aboard your ship.
You don't need the resources of Ymir, I asked.
Cadence made a tiny clucking sound, which I took to be the machine person equivalent of a derisive snort. The citizens of Naomi mean well, but using their machines to repair Hesperus would be like trying to perform brain surgery on you with a few pieces of flint.
If flint's all you have, you go with flint.
Cascade's ivory mask shaped a thin smile.
But we can do better than that. We are flexible machines. The humanoid forms we assume now are mere conveniences. It would be a simple matter for us to form the necessary interfaces to assist Hesperus. But first, we must be aboard your ship.
That can be arranged. But I'd still like to bring him down to Naomi.
There is no need, Cascade said again.
For me there is. It's complicated. But Hesperus asked us to do something for him. I took a deep breath. You've already spent time on Naomi. Doubtless you know of the spirit of the air.
Yes, Caden said guardedly.
Have you had contact with it since your arrival?
She, I could not help but think of the machine as a she, shook her slim-necked, imperious head.
None at all. There has been no need. It is not a true machine intelligence, and therefore of only passing interest to us.
Does that apply to people as well?
Quite the contrary. We find organic intelligences infinitely fascinating, or that slippery grey meat emulating consciousness. What is there not to be fascinated by?
The spirit, Cascade said, represents an intermediate stage of sophistication between human and true machine consciousness. Its origin is obscure, its nature unstable. There are too many variables to make it amenable as a study subject.
And, I thought quietly, you might fear it a little as well. If it scared humans, then it might hold similar terrors for machine people.
Campion caught my eye from across the balcony and winked once. Well, I'm interested in it, I said. Hesperus was fully aware of our destination. It is our belief that he wished to be brought into the presence of the spirit.
What purpose do you expect that to serve? Cascade asked.
There are documented instances of the spirit interceding to heal injured pilgrims, or repair damaged machines, I said. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility that the spirit will do something similar for Hesperus.
Or take him apart.
In which case he'll have communicated part of himself into the memory of the spirit. He must have been willing to take that chance.
This is most unorthodox, Cadence said.
Being here
is unorthodox. Having an injured machine person for a guest is unorthodox. Nonetheless...
There was a silence. The machines stood still, but the lights in their heads flared and spun like demented fireflies. I had the sense of some vast, inscrutable conversation taking place before me, at a speed I could scarcely comprehend. Those seconds of silence might have consumed subjective years of frenzied debate in the accelerated time frame of machine consciousness. They are cleverer than us, I thought, cleverer and stronger and faster, and soon it will come to a head, us or them.
We will journey to your ship and inspect Hesperus, Cadence said.
Cascade added, we will attempt to establish a communication link with him. If that fails, you may bring him down to the surface and present him to the spirit. I felt dizzy and elated in equal measure. I could not begrudge them a chance at communication first. At the very least, it might enable Hesperus to clarify his wishes.
Thank you, I said when I had gathered my thoughts again. I'm enormously grateful.
You were expecting obstruction, Cascade asked mildly.
I wouldn't have been offended if you'd refused. He's our guest, but he's your fellow citizen. If you felt that you had a better claim over him, I wouldn't have argued.
But you would have been sad, Cadence said.
Yes, I'd have felt as if we'd let him down.
We would not want that to happen. You have taken care of him until now, and we are grateful to you for that.
Cascade turned to face his silver companion, then glanced back at me. When may we visit your ship, Purslane?
As soon as I have line authorization to take my shuttle back into orbit. That shouldn't be a problem, but it may take a few hours.
Cadence bowed. Then we shall await your instructions.
Chapter 15. In the early afternoon of our first full day on Naume, the other three shuttlings we had transported were released from abeyance. By the time they emerged into daylight, on the large landing deck where we had gathered the night before, they had the stunned, wary look of people who could not quite believe their reversal of fortune. It was as if they had woken from one dream and could not quite shake the sense that they were now in another, from which they might be roused at any moment. When they had met the customary grouping of shatterlings, guests and civic dignitaries, fewer in number than the evening before, not that Lucerne, Melilot and Valerian would ever know, they came over to speak to Purslane and me.
Akun Knight told us what happened, Campion, Melilot said to me. We can't ever repay you for what you've done for us.
You'd have done the same, I said.
I'd like to think so, but I won't ever know for sure. The point is you did do it, knowing the risks. Thank you, Campion and Purslane. You make me proud to be Gentian.
There's talk of censure, I said, glancing over my shoulder to check whether Bettany might still be in earshot. Purslane and I will need all the friends we can get if it comes to a vote as to how we should be punished.
They can't be serious, said the darkly handsome Valerian. They are, unfortunately, Purslane said, but if we have at least some allies, I feel better already.
You'll have more allies than you imagine, Lucerne said. Then she looked sharply at the other two. Grilsa and the others. What happened to them?
They're here, I said, still in stasis. Mazarian's been charged with getting information out of them.
She'll do it, too, Valerian said.
You make that sound like a bad thing.
Melilot lowered her voice. Mazarian was zealous when it came to interrogating Grilsa.
I'd have been pretty zealous myself, Purslane said.
But not as much as Mazarian. We almost had to restrain her. We didn't want the prisoner dying on us before we got anything useful out of him. And now she's in charge of them all?
There'll be due oversight, I said.
There'd better be, Lucerne said. None of us gives a damn what happens to Grilsa. They can throw him to the wolves for all I care, but not before the fuckers talked.
The afternoon was eventful. Seifel was making arrangements to recover my strand from the heads of the surviving shatterlings, which meant each of us submitting to a delicate, time-consuming memory read. The hard part was not preparing the equipment, for the machinery was easily fabricated from standard maker files, but organizing us all so that the work could be accomplished in days, not weeks. As a token of goodwill, and to show that I was not purposefully concealing anything, I offered myself up as her first subject.
I can skip you, Campion, Sifel said when we were alone in the room assigned for her work. It's kind of you to offer, but there'll be interference between the Strand and your own base memories of the same experiences. I've never understood why the line insists on each of us receiving our own strands.
Tradition, I said, and a safeguard against sabotage. If I decided to plant something nasty in the head of every other Shatterling, I couldn't do it without infecting myself.
You could take precautions if that was what you intended.
But it would be more complicated and therefore more likely to go wrong. All the same, I suppose the tradition is more symbolic than practical. Do you want to scan me or not?
Yes, assuming you've got nothing better to do. Wouldn't you rather be watching Miserion getting her kicks?
I detect a faint note of disapproval.
Sifel wrinkled her nose, as if there was a bad smell in the room. Let's give it a try. If the signal-to-noise ratio is too low to be useful, I'll discard you from the set.
Sounds painful.
Lie down here, she said, with exaggerated sternness. Sifel knew that I liked her, and there was a pleasurable tension in all our exchanges. I think she liked me a little bit as well. I lay on the couch and breathed out while she began her work. She took a thing like a tube of paint and squeezed the contents onto her left hand and arm, up to her elbow, forming a thick web of waxy lines that reached from the crook of her arm to the tips of her fingers. She had many rings on her left hand, none on the right, but she kept the waxy lines from interfering with her jewelry. In seconds, the aspic of machines cured into a flexible network. Sifel held her hand close to my scalp, as if she was warming her palm from a hot stone. She moved the hand slowly, fingers stiffened like a dancer's, occasionally glancing aside at a summary updating on the room's wall. As the scalp-penetrating sensors rummaged through my memories, identifying those patterns tagged as being part of a strand, I felt brief, subliminal flickers of recall ghosting into consciousness, like pictures projected faintly onto a screen. It was like walking into palatial, feeling the game pick through my mind.
Did you get anywhere with the flight logs?
Keep still. This'll go a lot quicker if you don't move and you don't talk.
Sorry.
To answer your question, I haven't looked at the logs yet. I'll do that once I've got enough strands read in to begin the correlative matching. The logs probably won't come to anything, but we may as well look into it. You owe me one, you realize. I saved your skin out there.
I mumbled agreement.
I'm sure you'll find a way to pay me back. One day I might do something as idiotic as wipe my own strands. Who knows?
With her free hand, Sifel pushed back a stray strand of blue-white hair.
You're infuriating, Campion. There are times when I think you embodied the best of what the line stands for, and other times when I think we should have excommunicated you circuits ago. Your problem is that you don't take it seriously enough, which is good sometimes. We can't all be like Fescue or Bettany, but other times... Well, I won't labour the point. I'm sure you'll hear it often enough in days to come. At least you have Perslain to keep you on the straight and narrow. You could power empires with that woman's patience. If it were me, we'd already have built a memorial to you. By which she meant that she would have killed me.
Sifel was soon done and invited me to move off the couch. You got a clean extraction?
No, worse than I was expecting. She peeled the waxy lines of aspic of machines from her arms and fingers, squeezing them into a ball which oozed back into the tube it had come from. Nothing I can work with yet, but by the time I've added together all the others, we should be getting somewhere. Just between you and me. Because it's going to come out anyway. You weren't trying to hide anything, were you? I mean, that's not why you deleted your strand.
If I had something to hide, I'm doing it so well I don't even know about it.
That could be true. The tricks we can play with memory. But...
Sifel trailed off.
After all this, I do trust you. You have your faults, not even you can deny that. But I don't think you had anything to do with the ambush. You're like a boy looking for pretty shells on a beach. You picked up something that caught your eye, and you brought it home and showed it off to everyone else. But even you didn't have any idea of its true significance.
Sifel paused significantly.
Someone did, though. Someone saw what you'd brought home and decided we all had to die because of it. Now all we have to do is find that shell.
I'm glad you made it, Sifel.
That makes two of us, she said. The four cabinets were grouped together on a raised plinth, surrounded by bare flooring. Mazerian had been given an entire room for her interrogations. Beyond the open area stood a series of stepped benches from which interested parties could witness the proceedings. Beyond the benches rose walls through which narrow slitted windows admitted pencil-thin shafts of wan daylight. There was more than enough space for all the chatterlings, as well as our guests and a small congregation of locals. Many witnesses were already present when the conveyor dropped me off outside, having just watched Perslane's shuttle climb back into the sky. I was burning with curiosity, desperate to hear what these frozen prisoners had to say of their part in the crime. Mazerian's timing and showmanship were impeccable. By the time she arrived, the atmosphere was electric and conversation dropped to an alert, anticipatory silence in an instant. She strode to the plinth and stood before it, the cabinets looming over her thin, dark-clad form. "Thank you, chatterlings and guests," she said, pivoting on her heels to address the audience. "Today I will be using Synchromesh to reach the prisoners." She raised one arm high so that her sleeve slipped down to reveal a bulky white chronometer, clamped around the pale stick of her wrist, the watch set with pearly dials and many knurled knobs. "Since you were warned, I presume that most of you have your own mesh, or an equivalent means of decelerating your subjective time flow. Please prepare to administer a slowdown rate of 100, but only at my command." She spun around and stepped onto the plinth, walking to the rightmost cabinet. Like the other three, its doors were open. The prisoner sat on a throne inside a buttressed red bubble of retarded time. "We only know the name of the man in the leftmost box. Grilsa's cabinet is better than the other three. He's got a much stronger chance of surviving emergence into normal time. For the other three, I consider the chances somewhat poorer. Husking is a distinct possibility. Because of this, I will not risk bringing them out of stasis until I am certain I have learned all I can without external coercion. But they do not know that." Mazerian opened the control panel in the rightmost cabinet, exposing the same kind of graduated dial I had seen in Grilsa's box when Mazerian had shown it to me aboard Dalliance. The lever was also pushed nearly all the way to the right, indicating a stasis factor near 100,000, a second for every day that passed in the external universe near enough. In the time that had elapsed since I had met the other chatterlings for breakfast, the prisoner might have had time to blink once. It would take 2 or 3 days of my time for him to complete a gesture or express a simple statement. Mazerian tugged the lever to the left until the stasis factor was 100. The prisoner still appeared immobile from moment to moment, but over the course of a minute, the rise and fall of his chest was just discernible. He was breathing, alive. The bubble was now pink-hued rather than scarlet. "He sees and hears only me," Mazerian said, looking back over her shoulder at the audience. "There's a privacy screen between you and me. Later, it may be possible to cross-examine the prisoners, but for now I would rather they dealt only with me. I do, of course, have quorum authority to lead this investigation." She touched the face of her chronometer with one sharp-nailed finger. "I am about to dial myself up. If you wish to follow the proceedings, do likewise. I suggest you set a 6-hour expiration, time enough for a few minutes of conversation." As the drug slowed her mental processes, Mazerian froze, falling into a pseudo-paralysis. It was in fact only a retardation of bodily functions, not a complete cessation, but she would have toppled from the plinth had her clothes not stiffened to provide the necessary support. Now her subjective consciousness rate had been matched to the prisoner's, and her heart and respiratory rates lowered accordingly. Her mouth opened very slowly, and sound appeared to come out of it. It was impossible to speak under the influence of Synchromesh. The physiology of the human voice box simply did not permit sounds to be generated across minutes of actual time. But her clothes were capable of reading her intentions, and they fed a simulation of Mazerian's voice to both the prisoner and the loudspeakers situated around the room. What we heard sounded as low and mournful as whale song, throbbing with subsonic undertones. I pulled a black vial from my pocket and squeezed 2 cold drops of Synchromesh onto my eyeballs. The drug hit my nervous system in moments, dulling my blink reflex. Using the chronometer, I set the 6-hour expiration and rotated the dial that would tell the drug how slowly I wished to go. I felt the usual lurch of dizziness as the mesh took hold. Afterwards, the only evidence that I was under the influence of the drug was the whirling progress of the normal minute hand on my chronometer, whipping around like a centrifuge. Most of the audience had dialed up at the same time as me. Only a handful were still living in normal time, betrayed by their fidgety, jerky movements. Mazarian's voice had upshifted through the frequencies until she sounded perfectly normal and comprehensible. "Of Gentian line, the House of Flowers," she was saying in trans, introducing herself. I had missed only a second or two of actual speech. "You are in our custody now, on a world whose name and location I have no intention of divulging. We're not interested in justice, merely cold-blooded retribution." The prisoner said nothing, but he was fully alive now, shifting in his throne restraints and eyeing Mazarian's every move. "We are, however, prepared to make concessions for information," she said, occasionally turning to face her hidden audience, her clothes permitting normal perambulation. "There are 4 of you, and we only need 1 of you to talk. Your cabinets are damaged. The chances of you surviving emergence into normal time are not excellent. If you are prepared to tell us what we want, I will make sure we do all in our power to keep you alive. But only if you cooperate. Only if you tell us everything without evasion, without ambiguity." Mazarian rested a hand on her hip. "What's it to be?" The prisoner smiled or sneered. It was difficult to tell which.
"I saw what we did to you, Gentian. I know how many we killed."
"There were survivors, more than you realized, and latecomers too."
"I only have your word on that."
"You want to see the others? I'll bring you out of stasis. That should feel real enough."
"You won't risk it. Bring me out and you stand a very good chance of ending up with nothing."
"You don't think I'll take that chance? You're not that precious to me."
"Again, I only have your word."
"You know how many of you were in the ship?"
"But I don't know how many of us survived. You can show me the other 3, but I don't have to believe I'm seeing anything other than a projection."
"Who sent you?"
"We did."
"Wrong answer. Tell me about the Marcelin involvement in this atrocity."
"You tell me."
"The Marcelins were tasked with disposing of the H-guns. If they'd done that, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Is there collusion at line level, or was Grilsa acting independently of the other Shatterlings?"
"Who's Grilsa?"
"My patience isn't infinite," Mazarian said. Her hand was on the lever of the stasis cabinet now. "I can pull this all the way to the left, bring you out. Would you like me to do that?"
"Whatever makes you happiest."
"Tell me what Campion's thread had to do with the ambush. What was in it that mattered so much?"
"Ask Campion, or did we kill him as well?"
"Are you a member of one of the lines? Are you Marcelin?"
"Do I look Marcelin to you?"
"I'd say you were Melicta, if I had to put money on it. I didn't notice the resemblance until you started speaking, but you all have that arrogant set to your jaws, that fuck you glint in your eyes." Mazarian watched him very intently, alert to the slightest betrayal of his true feelings. It was frustrating, not being able to look into his mind directly, but no useful scans could penetrate the stasis bubble.
"You think I'm working for the House of Moths? Take it up with them."
Mazarian nodded sagely. "You're one of them. A star mover." Without warning, her hand pushed the dial to its earlier setting, freezing the Shatterling into immobility. Even with Synchromesh, he appeared inert, since there was still a 1,000-fold gap between our time rates.
"If he's Melicta, I want to know now," Mazarian said.
Behind her, the light that rammed through the narrow slots in the walls changed its angle perceptibly. From elsewhere in the audience, Aconite spoke up. "There'll be a list of all Melicta Shatterlings in the trove. It won't guarantee a match. They change their looks the same way we do, but there's no harm in checking."
"Do it," Mazarian said, "and don't forget to check against Shatterlings lost to attrition."
Aconite's hand moved to his chronometer.
He dialed himself back into normal time and became a blur as he moved to the exit of the interrogation room. The door opened and closed, flashing dusky sky for an instant. A few subjective seconds later, the door flashed again and Aconite was back in his chair, adjusting into our time flow. "We've got a name," he said, "a malictus shatterling named Thorn. He was lost to attrition 10 of their circuits ago."
"Same time as Grilsa, give or take a circuit," Mazarian said. "That makes two of them, both shatterlings presumed dead, but who were alive after all. Perhaps we should take a closer look at the other two. We might find the same story."
"There's a question I'd like to ask him," I said. Mazarian's gaze snapped onto me. If she was grateful for my having rescued her, no trace of that gratitude now remained. "What, Campion?"
"I'd like to know if he's heard of the House of Suns."
"There's no such line," Mazarian said. "I'd still like to see how he reacts."
"Why? What do you imagine he might say? Grilsa never mentioned such a thing."
"I've just got a suspicion that something called the House of Suns may be involved. It was something Hesperus mentioned, although his memory was too damaged for him to say where the phrase originated."
"How can there be a line no one's heard about?" asked Charlock. "We know what we are, who's in the commonality, who's been expelled. There's no room in our history for a hidden line."
"A line could have arisen recently," said Valerian, "one too new to have entered the troves."
"We might as well ask," Melilot said, leaning forward in her seat. "I agree with Campion. Everything points to a connection with the Vigilance, and we know Hesperus was interested in that. If we had thousands of years, we could send someone back to the Vigilance to ask some more questions, but we don't. So we have to make do with what we have on Neume."
I glanced down at my chronometer, at the viciously whirling hand. We had been in Mazarian's time frame for nearly 4 minutes of subjective time. In the real world, nearly 6 hours had elapsed.
"Ask him," I said.
A scowl played across Mazarian's face. She did not care to be dictated to, but she yanked the lever back to the 100 setting.
"Having fun?" the prisoner asked.
"Your Thorn, a shatterling of Malictaline," Mazarian said. "You were believed lost to attrition. You attempted to slingshot through a double degenerate binary and miscalculated the tidal forces. So the troves tell us, in any case."
"If you say so."
"There is no doubt." Mazarian's eyes flashed in my direction resentfully. "But tell me something else, Thorn. Tell me about the House of Suns."
"There's no such thing."
But his answer, we all saw, had been just too glib, too quick.